VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Humankind has long been fascinated with the planet Mars. Historians have traced some of the earliest observations of what has become known as the Red Planet to those made by ancient Egyptian astronomers around 1600 to 1300 BC. Other ancient civilizations, such as the Chinese, the Babylonians, and the Greeks, also made notable observations of Mars in the time before the Common Era. Legendary Italian astronomer, physicist, and engineer Galileo Galilei is credited with the first use of a telescope to look at Mars back in 1609. Modern exploration of Mars began in earnest during the dawn of the space age in the early 1960s when the U.S. and the former Soviet Union sent spacecraft in attempts to fly by or even land on the Red Planet. Most of those early attempts failed in some way. It wasn't until 1965 when NASA's Mariner 4 spacecraft successfully flew by, captured, and transmitted the first close-up images of the Red Planet. The first successful landing of a spacecraft to perform a soft landing on Mars was the USSR's Mars 3. It failed, however, after nearly 2 minutes on the Martian surface. NASA's Viking 1 in July 1976 was the first to not only softly land on Mars, but successfully perform its scheduled mission. In the years since, a number of missions have been sent out to fly by, orbit, land, or wander across and explore the Red Planet. The space agency's currently operating rover, Curiosity, has been providing breakthrough findings about Mars since it touched down in August 2012. The discoveries made by the various probes, orbiters, and rovers that have been exploring the Red Planet over the past 50 years have made many of us quite excited about the possibility of someday sending humans to visit our neighbor in the solar system. NASA is now preparing to launch its newest rover, Perseverance, to the Red Planet. As of this program, the launch is currently scheduled for July 30th, but can launch from then until August 15th in the event of difficulties. So today we'll discuss the upcoming Mars 2020 mission, the new Perseverance rover, and what scientists hope to learn about the Red Planet. My guest who joins us today via Skype is Michael Meyer. He is the chief scientist for Mars exploration at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Michael, as you know, excitement is building over the upcoming launch of the Mars 2020 Perseverance mission. Can you give us a bit of an overview of the mission, its goals, objectives, and what we hope to learn from it?
I'm really excited about the launch of Perseverance that will happen this summer. It's an exciting mission. It has an architecture very much like Curiosity. So you have to be paying attention if you see the two rovers side by side to understand what the differences are. And the Perseverance rover is actually sort of the culmination of our capabilities on the surface of Mars, where we are now getting to the point where we can identify and select samples and cache them. We can put them in a depot. With a later mission, we can bring them back to Earth. So this is the key that separates this mission from all the other missions that we've had. And it'll be the first time that we've had the opportunity to bring pieces of another planet back to our planet.
So what you're saying is that part of the Mars 2020 mission will be to collect rock and soil samples for possible return to Earth. Can you tell us how this would be accomplished?
Yeah, bringing samples from another planet has never been done, and it is somewhat of a complicated process, but we have separated out into manageable parts. So the idea is that you can do step one, see how you're doing, do step two, see how that's progressed, and then do step three. So for this mission, Mars 2020, extremely sophisticated instruments meant specifically to identify samples that would be most interesting to bring to Earth. So, and its job is to find them, take cores, and then cache them on the surface of Mars. So then you have your samples all packaged up on the surface of Mars. They're safe there, sitting there, just waiting for the next step. So the next step is We send a lander to the surface of Mars that has a small fetch rover on it that will go and get those samples, bring them back to the lander. The lander happens to have a rocket on it. This is not the rocket that got it to the surface. This is the rocket that's going to take whatever it has off the surface of Mars. So that fetch rover is going to put the samples into that rocket and launch it from Mars into Mars orbit. For the samples is on the order of a little bit larger than a soccer ball. And it will be in orbit, and actually it's stable in orbit. It can stay there for quite some time. We're not really interested in waiting a long time. We want to go and get it. So the other part of the mission is how to bring it back to Earth. So the Europeans are building an orbiter that will go into orbit around Mars, see this activity, see this soccer ball size being put into orbit and orbiting around Mars. It will go and grab it, package it, and then send it to Earth. And then it'll rocket back here and land on the surface of Earth to the waiting arms of the world scientist.
Is there any timeline or specific plans as to when we can expect the retrieval of the Mars samples for return to Earth?
Yeah, we've actually gone through a fair amount of technical, what we call them technical interchanges. And this is where groups of engineers get together and say, okay, how are we going to do this? What are the requirements? How much does this weigh? How many samples are you scientists talking about? And, you know, that sort of thing, back and forth. And so we already have a plan. We have the Europeans launching their mission and the U.S. launching the lander in 2026. They go to Mars. They take a little bit of time. They actually get there at different times. And the whole idea is the orbiter gets there earlier than the lander, so the orbiter can watch the lander land and make sure that when the rocket takes off from the surface of Mars, it can see it, so it knows where those samples are right away without having to spend quite some time looking for it. And then when the lander's on the surface, it's going to take something like a year searching around to go and get the samples and bring them back to the rocket. When all said and done, then it takes off of Mars, and we expect to get those samples back in 2031.
When and where on Mars will the Perseverance spacecraft touch down? I understand that among a number of reasons the landing site was selected was that it offers a variety of geological features for exploration. Why was this landing spot selected?
We have had sample return on our minds for a long time. In fact, the first exobiology strategy for Mars exploration, which was published in 1997, had a step-by-step process of how do we explore Mars to look for life. Well, we're at the step where we go with the right instruments, pick samples, and send them back to Earth. So this is, we follow this timeline of how do you explore a planet so you can determine whether or not there was any life. So it has been a long study process of what should we do? What do we need to learn about Mars so that we can understand it as a planet? By understanding it as a planet, we can understand its potential for life. And by understanding its potential for life, we then understand where we should go to look for those signs of life. So that's where we are with Jezero Crater. We've learned enough about the planet to know that the obvious thing, that today's surface is cold and dry. But what we have learned in the last decade or so of research is that early Mars was warmer and wetter. And subsequently, we've learned that Mars is a diverse and dynamic planet. So there's only certain places that offer us a good window into what was going on in early Mars. Jezero Crater is one of those windows into the past. And what's great about it is the crater, it looks like there is a lake in the crater. We see a delta, which shows that water was flowing into the crater and left its sediment. And it's surrounded by ancient terrain that tells us is a window into the various earliest parts of Mars. So, and from orbit, we can tell minerals that are there that are in association with water and are often, at least here on Earth, good places where evidence of life might be preserved. So Jezero Crater has almost something for everyone. And so that's such a good way to go, because if we're talking about the first samples that we get from another planet, we know that we're not that clever. And betting everything on one certain type of rock is not a good idea. We don't know enough. So we're looking for a real diversity of rock types that are available in one landing site, and Jezero Crater has that. So it has something for everyone and very good possibilities for evidence of life if it ever got started on Mars.
I think it's interesting that the selected site was once a body of water. And of course, when we're talking about looking for signs of life in the cosmos, we talk about the habitable zone of exoplanets where it would be possible to host liquid water, which indicates possibilities for life to exist. So I can see the possibilities of looking for signs of life on Mars.
Yeah, oh, most certainly. In fact, one of the surprises about life on Earth that we've only learned, you know, in the last 40 years or so, is life exists where we didn't really expect it. We thought it'd be too hot, you know, or too cold, that sort of thing. And we found it in hydrothermal vents in the bottom of the ocean. And it seemed that the only real criteria is whether or not there's liquid water. And so liquid water then became sort of the proxy for the place to go and look for life. On Mars, we believe there's liquid water on Mars, but we suspect it's in the very deep surface, a subsurface. So it's not really accessible right now. However, in the past, there was water on the surface. So where we think water was stable for an extended period, just like lake sediments here on Earth, there should be a long-term record, and if there's any life, that there be a preservation of that.
Michael, you're talking about the existence of water on Mars. I'm taking it that the existing water that is on or near the surface is frozen.
Yeah, the ice that we find, well, for one, Mars has a very low atmospheric pressure. So what happens is ice on Mars is actually not stable in the lower latitudes. It's too warm. And what happens is, like, if you took some ice from the pole, there's ice in the poles on Mars. If you just took it with you and went down south or north, depending upon which pole you're on, it would sublimate. It would turn from ice to gas. It wouldn't go through a liquid phase. It's like dry ice here on Earth. Which is frozen carbon dioxide. It goes directly from ice to gas. So liquid water itself, we don't expect to find it on the surface except for extremely short periods of time or extremely salty water, that sort of thing. We found things that make us think maybe it's there, but we haven't found evidence of liquid water on the surface yet.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the Internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel VOA for alerts and program updates. Today on the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we're talking about NASA's new rover called Perseverance and its Mars 2020 mission scheduled for launch on July 30th. My guest who is joining us via Skype is Michael Meyer. He is the chief scientist for Mars exploration at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Michael, we've examined some of the lofty goals for Perseverance. Let's talk about the spacecraft itself and its instruments. As with Curiosity to the previous Mars rovers, I'm taking it that the technology used for the instruments aboard Perseverance are much more sophisticated compared to Curiosity. Can you tell us about the instruments on Perseverance and what they do?
Yes, they're very sophisticated because, you know, in some ways, they've been built, what, 7-8 years later, or at least the start of their build. So you can imagine that you have that advantage of technological advancement. The other thing to keep in mind is when you build one thing, you learn how to do it better and you go, oh, that's the way I should have done it to start with. So we have some instruments that are improvements upon the instruments that we had on Curiosity. And so I'll pick two examples. One is SuperCam, which is on Curiosity, we had a laser desorption mass spectrometer. So essentially, it shoots a laser and is able, through a spectrometer, to measure elemental composition. So what elements are there? Is that carbon? Is that argon? Whatever the story is. SuperCam, which is on Perseverance, yes, it has the laser, has that instrument, but also included is an infrared spot spectrometer. So it uses now long wavelength infrared light to give you what mineralogy of the things that it's looking at. And then also the capability to do some Raman, which is a different technique that also gives you mineralogy. So all of that is now the, quote, looks like the same camera, but much more improved. Another example is the camera, Mass Cam, which was on Curiosity, is a very capable instrument, and it has two focal lengths. So it can get long distance and near fields of view. So MassCam Z, which is on Perseverance, has a zoom lens. So it's just like on your camera where you turn the dials and you can focus on anything far away or you can focus things closer. You can, in fact, do a focus through the whole distance that you want to observe. So that's fantastic. Now, remember that one of the big goals of Perseverance is to cache samples for return to Earth. So instead of an analytical laboratory that Curiosity has on the inside where it can actually ingest some samples and do some composition and mineralogy experiments, it's basically a sampling system, you know, where you can hold tubes, put your cores in the tubes, store the tubes. So the somewhat equal amount of volume, instead of a analytical laboratory, is taken up by the caching capabilities. Now, because a major focus is to figure out which samples you want to bring back, on the arm, there are two new-to-Mars instruments. One is Pixel, and what this does is uses X-ray to give you elemental composition, but what's spectacular about it is that it does that as an image. So it can give you spatial location of the elements that it's measuring. So for that, when you're talking about biology, biology takes advantage of interfaces where you have one mineral that's different from the mineral next to it. There's basically a chemical potential difference. So microbes can take full advantage of it. And also, if things get trapped or a concentration mechanism, you get a barrier, you get that sort of thing. So with Pixel, you can see not only your elemental composition spatially, but you can find those barriers and things that may look really interesting compared to another. And then the other instrument is Sherlock. And this has a hand lens on it, but also it uses ultraviolet light for Raman spectroscopy. So it gives you mineralogy and it also gives you spatial resolution. So you can see the minerals and how they're spread out in a small area. So both those two instruments are totally geared toward looking at a particular rock at a very fine scale to find out if that has the kind of things that you would be looking for to bring a sample back, not only for the geology and geochemistry that you're doing, but also potentially for evidence of life. The added advantage of UV Raman is that it can detect some organic compounds. So that would be a real boon if we see some organic compounds to bring us back. There's several other instruments. It's a spectacular set. One of the things is a radar for looking into the subsurface. So things that we see on the surface, we can see if they are continuous down through the subsurface. That'll be very interesting. We even have an instrument that is geared toward preparing for human exploration. And that is MOXIE. This instrument, what it does, it takes carbon dioxide and strips off the carbon and gives you pure oxygen. And pure oxygen is a great, quotes, oxidizer, hence the name. So when you have rocket fuel, you have a reducer and an oxidizer. Your oxidizer is actually the heavy. And if you can make that on Mars, you can save yourself a lot of effort of bringing stuff, all of the components to your rocket fuel to that planet. You could actually make some of it there and only bring the light stuff.
One part of the Mars 2020 mission a lot of people were talking about, and I'm especially curious, is the Mars helicopter Ingenuity, which will be hitching a ride attached to Perseverance. Can you tell us about it and what it will do once launched on Mars?
Wow. Yeah, so first off, it is a technology demonstration. So that means, in many ways, it's basically the bonus thing that we're sending to Mars, because if it doesn't work, you know, it's sad, it's too bad, but the mission objectives are going to be met. All the things we want to do with the mission will happen. But if it works, we just demonstrated the capability to fly in another planet's atmosphere. So that is the big desire. The import of that is, and why a helicopter, is with it, you can do local reconnaissance. So I'll give you a short example of a rover's on the surface. Its mast is 2 meters above the surface. It can only see so far in terms of being resolved things at a distance. It also has, there's a challenge called foreshortening. So if you're looking at very hilly terrain and you look out from your rover, all you see are the tops of the hills. And you can't see what's in between. You don't know how long it is. And you don't know how steep or rough the surface is in between. All you can see is the top parts. With a helicopter, you go up 20 feet. You can see much better looking down. And you can actually fly over it if you want to really check it out. So the helicopter gives you the capability of local reconnaissance, and you can prepare much better how to explore the area and determine what you'd really want to take your heavy roving vehicle, which direction you want to go to find the things that you're looking for.
How will the helicopter be controlled? Will it be driven by a computer on Perseverance, or will there be actually an operator on Earth with the controls?
One of the things to keep in mind is Mars is not very close to Earth, and it's far enough away that at the best of times, it's 8 minutes for us to hear from Mars. And at the worst of times, when Mars is on the other side of the sun compared to Earth, it's like 40 minutes. So can you imagine trying to fly a helicopter where you tell it to turn right, and then you have to wait at a minimum of 8 minutes before you know, right? It's just, it's not possible. So it's going to fly autonomously. It's been programmed to go through certain things. And I want to emphasize, this is a very modest approach to how to do this helicopter, because it is going to be all autonomous. And it is a technology demonstration. We're not sure that it can fly on Mars. There may be things that we didn't surprise us. It's going to start the rotors, you know, and go up and down. That's it. It's going to land in the same place that it left. It's just going to say, yeah, I can actually lift off from Mars. And it only has 5 planned flights. The real design is to test whether or not you can fly a helicopter on Mars.
Michael, I'm curious about the role that other spacecraft on or near Mars will play in getting Perseverance from orbit down to the surface safely. I remember when Curiosity was getting ready to make its landing on Mars back in August of 2012, that the spacecraft orbiting the planet played a key part in coordinating the landing.
Yeah, I mean, you raise a really good point. So the landers that are on Mars right now, InSight and Curiosity, are not going to do much for Perseverance when it lands, other than, you know, sort of like the grandfather telling the stories. Well, when I was on the surface of Mars, this is what I learned, right? So, you know, there's that information and knowledge gained from the rover going around on Mars. You know, what things should we do? I mean, a good example is Curiosity showed that we actually need beefier wheels for Perseverance, and we did that. We put slightly heavier wheels and improved their performance. So they're not going to help with the mission that much. But the orbiters play a critical role. So there's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and there's Odyssey that are orbiting Mars now. There's also European orbiters, the ExoMars rover Trace Gas Orbiter, and then there's also the Mars Express Orbiter. They have different instrumentation, but all of them to one degree or another, are observing the atmosphere and can tell you something about what's going on Mars. So first off, one of the things that's going to happen is as Perseverance is heading toward the red planet, we're getting information back from the orbiter saying, hey, the weather, you know, it's a good day on Mars. The weather's nice. The sun's out, you know, that kind of thing. And so the entry, descent, and landing parameters for how long did you go before you drop the back shell? How long do you go before you pop the parachute? When do we turn on the retro rockets? All of that can be adjusted a little bit depending upon how thick we think the atmosphere is or how far out it is from the planet, because it can balloon out. And an obvious example is, let's say a local dust storm started up, you know, as Perseverance is about to get there. Well, that changes the nature of the atmosphere that this spacecraft has to go through to land safely on Mars. And we want to know that. More than likely, you don't have to adjust anything, but we might have to. So it's important to know. The other thing that with Curiosity is orbital reconnaissance. Even though we've studied the area, taken lots of images, we understand where certain minerals are, we have high resolution imagery. As we're exploring, we're learning from the rover. So Perseverance is going to send back information such as, oh, this is not really basalt. This is something else. Or you know, this, where we thought this delta was, I think it's over here a little bit. So there's a shift for some reason. So we get that feedback into the orbital information we get. So we can adjust what we already have taken images of, but also it can change what we take images of as the rover goes along its path so that we can help plan better what would be the most interesting things in this for future exploration.
Will Perseverance play a role in laying the groundwork for future human missions to Mars? If so, how?
Yeah, certainly Perseverance has gaining information that's really going to help prepare for human exploration on Mars. You know, some of it is as simple as how rocky is rocky from what we thought it was before we landed, things that we learn about the mineralogy in the area. And there's some obvious things. I mentioned that there's the instrument called MOXIE that is going to extract oxygen out of the atmosphere. So that's a demonstration of, okay, yeah, we can make one component of rocket fuel on the red planet. So that really helps future exploration. And also oxygen, as you might imagine, is very useful for human explorers too, since that's what we breathe and use. So it's preparing that way. We're also doing weather measurements with the weather station that's on the rover. And that gives us some feedback about things that we should anticipate. We also get how variable the dustiness in the atmosphere may be at Jezero Crater. So that gives an idea of other things that we need to prepare for, like abrasion on seals and that kind of thing. And then what we're learning about Mars itself, what we understand about its past, can very much help inform us where ice deposits might be for future human exploration. We don't expect to find anything at Jezero Crater, but what we learn will inform us about what we know about early Mars and where there's real potential for ice, besides, you know, where we might see it from orbit. So there's several different things that play into that really do help human exploration in preparation to make it a little bit easier than the difficult task that it is. I would like to add one thing that we actually didn't really get a chance to touch on is it may not be recognized, but this is very much an international mission. We have international cooperation on the rover itself. We have international instruments from France, from Norway, from Spain. And those are the obvious ones. And we have components from all over the world. So very much, although this is, quotes, a U.S. mission, it wouldn't happen unless we had a lot of cooperation from our international partners. And that really makes this not only a great thing to do for us, but I think it makes a great thing to do for the world.
Michael, thank you so much for taking time today to talk with us about NASA's new Mars rover and its upcoming Mars 2020 mission.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
That was Michael Meyer. He is the chief scientist for Mars exploration at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. He joined us today via Skype. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today, and be sure to join Carol Castillo again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.